Good afternoon, members. We'll call this meeting of the Education Finance Committee to order. The first order of business is going to be a McDonald bill, House File 1586. If Representative McDonald wants to come forward and welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Now, Representative McDonald, we do not have a quorum quite yet, so we're not going to take action on, we're not going to move your bill before this committee until a quorum is present. At that time, we'll take up the oral amendment that you have to amend line 2.9. Could you just state what that oral amendment is, and then at the appropriate time, we'll deal with that?
Yes, the oral amendment will be changing the effective date from July 1st of 2011 to July 1st, 2012.
Okay. Thanks. Representative Grandling, is that cool?
Mr. Chair, that's fine. And you said the fiscal note is causing us to not deal with this bill right now?
Yeah, my understanding is that there's a fiscal note. Maybe I should let the staff. There's a fiscal note in process, or we believe that's coming, so we're not going to be taking action on this bill. Is that
Mr. Chair, members, there is a fiscal note that's being developed, and in the draft note there was some initial indication the Department of Education would have some administrative costs in, because they aren't administering these grants now, so it would be a new duty for them.
Thank you. Representative Grinning, is it okay? Representative Grinning.
Well, Mr. Chair, maybe I should listen to Representative McDonald first. I have a question, but he might answer it, so I'll wait.
Representative McDonald, welcome to the committee. Please proceed with your testimony and any testifiers you have with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a pleasure to be in front of this group again. My bill basically changes the nomenclature on line 114 in regards to reimbursements and allows the Commissioner of Education, to the extent that funds are available, shall reimburse all schools and other approved organizations offering motorcycle training safety education courses. Currently, right now, the Department of Education, the Department of Public Safety, allocates funds for MNSCU schools who offer this, but in the bill, currently, as is written, it says it may reimburse all schools, which include private schools. Currently, in the state of Minnesota, there's over, I think there's five private individuals that offer this training as well. And the funds that are created by the users, motorcycle enthusiasts who pay a registration fee, goes into a pool of money. That pool of money is supposed to be distributed by the Department of Education and or the Department of Public Safety. There's some discrepancies at this point. And right now, it's just going to MNSCUs. It's not going to the private mom-and-pop fellas, as the law was supposed to be. We want a free marketplace and all things being equal. We believe the law is interpreted incorrectly, and those funds should be allowed to be sent out to private individuals as well. I brought along a good friend of mine who also has a business in my hometown of Delano, Mr. Jed Duncan, who will answer some questions should you have any.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Did you have a statement at all to make before we move into questions from the public and or the committee?
Mr. Chairman, committee, thank you. No, simply to state that this is not against MNSCU in any way, shape, or form. They provide a valuable service, as do now, since 2008, private vendors. And the only thing is, since 2008, MNSCU's enrollment has gone down every year, while private vendors like myself have gone up. We've trained more motorcyclists. The question then is, why do people have to pay more money to go to one of the private vendors? And even though they do have to pay more money, the enrollment's increasing. The money is there. It's just not being dispersed to all Minnesotans, despite the fact that all Minnesotans that ride legally must have a motorcycle endorsement. Fees collected by the Department of Public Safety for that endorsement are what go to fund motorcycle training. It's not a taxpayer issue. I think it's cool. Motorcyclists pay for motorcycle training. But currently, 400,000 motorcyclists pay for the motorcycle training that only some, the students that go to MNSCU, benefit from.
And, sir, could you please state your name for the record so 100 years from now when we listen to the tape, we'll
talking? Wow. Sir, I go by Jed. My formal name is James. Jed is my initial. So if you look me up on the register without any felony convictions, you'll probably find nothing. But it's Jed if you're on Google or whatever, and it's James if you're formally. Duncan is the last name, D-U-N-C-A-N. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. And members, we do have a quorum, so we'll call this meeting to order. The chair will move House File 1586 for possible inclusion in a later bill. The chair will also move the oral amendment stated by Representative McDonald earlier to amend line 2.9 from the effective date of 2011 to the effective date of 2012. Any discussion on that amendment? Representative Brad? Okay. All those in favor of the amendment, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. The bill has been amended as the author would like. This is a public hearing, so are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns about the bill? Welcome to the committee, sir. If you could please state your name for the record as well.
Mr. Chair, members, Kevin McHenry, the Department of Education. I appreciate you all taking a look at this bill and holding it over to take a look at the fiscal note. A couple of things I just wanted to point out, just moving forward on this, as already was testified, currently MDE is not receiving the funds from the Department of Public Safety where this is being collected. So this would be a new administration of how we are going forward in allocating funds to programs or areas that are distributing these funds for these programs. One thing I did want to point out, I appreciate delaying the implementation date, and I appreciate the collection process that we can pay up to 50% of the cost. One thing I did want to put out there, just a suggestion for this as it's moving forward, as far as the data is being collected, we don't know, since this is a new program, how many schools and how many organizations are offering these programs, so that's something that we would have to collect. And then as far as the up to the 50% reimbursement, another point, up to the 50% reimbursement, it might be difficult for us to determine upfront how much would be reimbursed as individuals were taking these courses, and it's something that we can definitely work on. I was looking up through just some pupil fee law questions in response to this, and districts are able to charge the full fee for these motorcycle safety courses. So so that I just wanted to put that on your plate for you all to think about as we are waiting for the fiscal note, is that districts can charge the full fee for these classes, and then we would reimburse after that, because we wouldn't have the data as far as how much we could prorate until the end of the year. So just to put some of those things on the table to think about before this bill comes up again, just wanted to do that. So I appreciate your time.
Thank you. And just do you know, do you know how many schools provide a motorcycle safety program that would get funds under this bill right now?
And Mr. Chair, members, that's something that we don't have all the data collected on, that because that's something that we haven't been doing. So that's something that we would put together on this.
Right now, we don't know that, though.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, no.
Are there any other different members of the public who wish to testify? Well, President Bradley, I'm going to take this public testimony. Then. Are there any additional members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns about the bill? Is there somebody from DPS here who could answer the question I just asked? Do you know the answer to that question that I just asked?
How many?
Why don't you come up to the microphone, sure. So. Right, welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, representatives. My name is Bill Schaefer. I manage the motorcycle safety program at the Department of Public Safety.
Thank you. And the question was, how many schools currently provide a motorcycle safety program that would get funds under this bill?
To my knowledge, there are 6 private providers at this time, and Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, several of their campuses offer rider training.
Okay. Thank you very much. So are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns about the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion of this, and Representative Bradley, you have the first question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McDonald, I'm not following this bill as well as I should, because I'm confused, and it looks like it's current law, so it's not like it's what you're doing. But the money is supposed to go to the Commissioner of Education, who may distribute it up to 50%. But the department said they're not actually receiving the money. You've been talking about MNSCU. So I'm thinking, does it now go to a higher ed, and then they're distributing it to colleges and universities and technical schools?
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative. I'm glad you asked that question, because frankly, I'm not sure why we're at this committee and not higher ed, because the money is allocated through the higher ed. Just for note, though, all the funds that are collected are through user fees. There should, unless, of course, staff will direct me in the right direction, there should be no fiscal cost to the Department of Education because it is self-revenue. The revenue is created through the user fees. So unless the staff can inform me as to why they believe there's a fiscal note from the Department of Education, I believe they're incorrect.
Well, Mr. McHenry kind of covered that in his testimonial. Do you want to come down and answer that again? Maybe you should just stay down here in case there's any other questions.
And I don't know if I want to get too comfortable up here.
Yeah, and just so you know, Representative Greinling's not done with you yet. So.
Hopefully not me either.
Mr. Chair, members, Kevin McHenry, Department of Education. I think, like I say, I think the fiscal notes are going through the fiscal note is going through the process. We don't have that completed as of yet. From my understanding, this is a fee that is collected through the Department of Public Safety when people are obtaining their driver's license for motorcycles, and so therefore the funds go through the Department of Public Safety. What's happening is for this program, it's supposed to go, in current law, I think you are correct, that it's supposed to go through the Department of Education, or it may go through the Department of Education. But to this point, we have not had the funds sent to the Department of Education from the Department of Public Safety as they're raising these funds to actually to reimburse these programs. So I think that's why we are, I think that's why there could be a fiscal note as far as a minor fiscal note, nothing major, but I think what the issue is this is an area that we have not been administering because it's been going through the Department of Public Safety and they've been raising the funds on that. So as we have to collect the data and administer this, there could be a potential small portion of administration cost to it.
And Representative Greinling, I think Mr. Crow can provide additional clarification. Mr. Crow.
Mr. Chair and members, just on the administrative portion of those costs, that the fiscal note doesn't necessarily imply that there will be a general fund cost. As you, if you look at the bill language, in current law, up to 5% of the collections can be allocated for administrative costs, and it references subdivisions 1 and 2, which includes the Commissioner of Education's role. So based on that, the administrative expenses could ultimately come out of the Motorcycle Safety Fund rather than out of the general fund. So Representative McDonald's point that this is sort of all internal to that fund is probably a valid one, but the department's point that there's a new responsibility for them is also a valid one, but it may not necessarily have to be covered with the general fund appropriation or be allocated to the general fund.
Representative Greinling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you know, it says all schools, and so I'm still confused. The testifier, Mr. Duncan, mentioned 5 more schools, or maybe it was Representative McDonald, and that they would be private schools. Are those higher ed, or are they K-12 schools?
Representative McDonald, or...
Mr. Chairman? Yep. Well, I'll try to answer that as well. Representative, it's all schools, not just private. These 6, or there are 5, now there's 6 that staff said there's 6 private schools that offer this kind of training.
And Representative McDonald, just to be clear, you're not talking about a private educational institution. You're talking about a private...
Yes, a mom-and-pop kind of facility. Entrepreneurs, correct, Mr. Okay, Chairman. So. And, yes.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair, are they higher ed or K-12?
Representative McDonald.
They are neither one.
Representative Greinling. They're private institutions. They're private institutions.
And Mr. Chair, and so are these now, we're going to start having this be for K-12 as well, when you not just these ma and pa organizations that you're talking about, but by inserting all in here, we're all of a sudden now starting with the K-12 schools, and it's only been for, I'm just trying to find out if this is just higher ed, why this wouldn't be the higher ed commissioner, and why we're saddling the K-12 or E-12 education commissioner with it. And if it's expanding and we haven't been giving it to K-12 schools before, then I'm wondering if the fees, what are they going to dwindle down to with that huge infusion of numbers of institutions to be covered?
And then Representative McDonald and Mr. McHenry, I think it's kind of related, just piggybacking Representative Greinling's question there, that So why aren't the schools getting this money now? But yeah. Let's go to the growling question first, and then just piggybacking on that topic. I'll give you some time to formulate your answer.
So Mr. Chairman, did you want me to answer Representative Greiling?
Yes, please do.
Yes. Frankly, I'm glad that I'm not the only one perplexed here. I'm not sure why it's in K-12. Your first question is, the answer is this. It has nothing to do with K-12. There will be no schools through K-12 that will be established if that's what the law, if we're misinterpreting the change in the word, then perhaps we have another change. But if I may say this, this particular program is simple. It was designed by the legislature in 1992, fortunately after my father was here, simply to create some funds. They increased the user fee, so any motorcycle enthusiast has to pay a little bit more in his license. And it was a pool of money to educate and offer safety training for motorcyclists. Why the Department of Education should even go through there is beyond me. So it goes to the Department of Public Safety, then the Department of Education. Let's add Health and Human Services too, and why not a couple other departments? So that's why the 5% administration costs in Subdivision 1 and 2 have been escalating. I don't think it needs to be in the Department of Education. It should be distributed through the Department of Public Safety.
Just to be clear, President McDonald, it's not Mr. Crow's decision, okay?
Oh! Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Not kill the messenger.
No, I'm very sorry. Yes, I'm a little passionate because of it's in my district, as you can all imagine. You want to help everyone in your district, especially if he's a donor to your campaign. No, no, he was not. I'm just teasing.
Yeah, you were joking when you said that.
Yeah, I guess that wasn't appropriate. I was completely kidding. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. McHenry?
I'm new at this still. So
yeah, you are. Mr. McHenry?
See, mouths are open, so my apologies.
Mr. Chair, members, this has been an interesting bill to research as it's come up, and we were going through that as to why. The one thing I can say is that the funds are raised through the Department of Public Safety, and through the statute, they are supposed to be... Or they may go through the Commissioner of Education. Why that's in statute, I'm not exactly certain, to be honest with you.
But do you know right now why? And certainly this is a practice that predated the Dayton administration. It's like there wasn't a change in policy at the Department of Education or DPS. It would seem, I mean, the statute reads pretty plainly that these dollars are supposed to flow to all areas. Do you know why that's not taking place right now?
And Mr. Chair, members, that's the question I was trying to that we were trying to get answered, and we thought maybe we'd learn that today as to why they were not being why that wasn't the case at what was happening. I don't know how much is raised through the Department of Public Safety in these funds to disperse, and as it hasn't been flowing to the department, we just don't have all the information as far as that. So
okay, let's bring DPS up here just so we can. Unless Mr. Crow, did you have something to add?
Tim, let's highlight why the education department's involved in CREP back in the day.
Sure. Well, let's go to let's have Mr. Strom, and then we'll go to DPS again. So that's why we have committees, and you'll listen this now and not on the floor.
Mr. Chair, members, this provision originally passed in 1982, so it predates me by a couple of years. But I think what's going on is the following. The MNSCU system wasn't created until the mid-90s, and prior to that, the technical colleges were separate, and prior to that, some of them were connected to schools. And my guess is, and perhaps EPS can comment on this, my guess is that the programs were likely offered by the technical colleges, and because they were more under the control of the Department of Education back in the pre-MNSCU days when they were still aligned with the school districts would be why there's a direction there. But the initial bill that passed was back in 1982, and that left the authority between DPS at DPS's discretion to determine whether it would allocate the money according to the statute, or alternatively authorize MDE to allocate some of the money as well. So the language dates back to the to 1982 with that $4 additional tax at that time on the motorcycle endorsement on the license. And DPS can probably speak to the amount, but to my knowledge, since that time, I don't think that money has been processed through Department of Education. I think it's been under the DPS control, and they've distributed according to the criteria of the statute.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. And does any of this relate to this, like, driver's education courses? And traditionally, those have taken place at the secondary, at high schools. Related to that,
Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to that. If the same, it may be Representative McDonald's witness may be able to say whether some of the motorcycle training is also provided by the private driver training companies or not. I'm not sure about that.
Okay. And to DPS, do you know why that's not being distributed right now, as Mr. Strom stated?
Mr. Chair, representatives, I'm Bill Schaefer, Department of Public Safety. That money goes to a motorcycle safety fund, and every time someone renews their endorsement, $7 of that renewal fee goes to a dedicated fund. On their first endorsement, $11 of that fee goes into this fund. Receipts fluctuate due to different numbers of people renewing their endorsements every year, but we average about $900,000 in receipts to that fund each year. Excuse me. With regard to the Department of Education, I wasn't here years ago, but I was told when this legislation first passed, the Commissioners of Public Safety and Education discussed the matter and implementation, and it was decided between those commissioners that public safety would take the lead in implementing the program. In 1986, public safety contracted with the Minnesota Institute of Public Health to operate the rider training courses. That contract, they did that for 4 years. In 1990, the Department of Public Safety contracted with a private company called Comprehensive Safety Systems. They managed, conducted the rider training for the Department of Public Safety from 1990 through 2002. In 2003, the department contracted with MNSCU to conduct the rider training around the state.
Okay. Representative Bradley, I think somehow you had the questions I kind of put in line.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I didn't do that. So
I liked your question. You know, why aren't the schools getting it now? And if there aren't any K-12 schools with this, and this is only coming here as a remnant of back before MNSCU, Representative McDonald, I think you could have an even better bill if you would get it out of, why do we want the K-12 schools and commissioner to deal with this? Just have it be, clean up that language and make it up to date and take it to a different committee.
Representative, it's not a bad idea. yes, sir.
If I might say on the issue of schools, that the private schools that have been discussed, those are commercial driving schools, and I think when this bill was first passed, again, long before my time, I think a lot of the drivers that took place through public high schools, and over the years, more and more that is in a private sector through commercial driving schools, et cetera. And the motorcycle training providers, those six providers, are all commercial driving schools, and oversight for those schools is through driver and vehicle services.
So Representative McDonald, and this is an open question, but it sounds like the real issue of the legislation is not as much to have this go through the education committee or not, but rather it is these funds are available for all training programs, for all motorcycle riders, not just the ones at MNSCU. Am I correctly stating what the problem is?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Okay. So this is something that we can, again, what we have in this bill, and we can work on this some more, but it sounds like we can work some more on it later. We're going to lay it over today anyways. We're not taking a vote on it. We certainly, I think that's the crutch of the issue, and maybe the education and the approval and the transfer of the money over to the Department of Education really, it sounds like that's legacy language. It's not even needed anymore. And so perhaps we can work on that to get that cleaned out of there and then send us over to public safety at some point in the future and have them correct the real root of the problem. Is that a fair statement, Representative McDonald?
Mr. Chairman, it is. Yes, certainly agree. I think this bill definitely needs some work, and Representative Greiling, I think we will take on that advice and proceed with that.
So the Greiling, I'll look for the Greiling Amendment? No, just if you want to work with staff, Representative Greiling, to make sure it addresses that, but I think that's a pretty good bit. Unless there's someone from the department who can explain why they want to be involved in this, Mr. McHenry, does the department have any objections to that? I love it when I ask a question and someone wasn't listening. Yeah. Just say, yeah, it's cool.
Mr. Chair, members, we're happy to work with Representative McDonald to make sure we can get this clarified.
Thank you. Any additional questions from members of the committee? Oh, is there an additional member of the public who wishes to testify? Hi, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Hello, chairmen and representatives. I'm Joanne Rasmussen. I'm the Rider Training Project Manager for the state of Minnesota. And currently I have a contract with the Minnesota Department of Public Safety, and I am here to represent 19 colleges and the students of Minnesota. And we right now we have a fantastic program. I mean, we have quality assurance. We have 180 instructors. Our program is standardized. We have the capability of training up to 12,000 students. Before that, with the private organizations running it, we had student complaints. It was not standardized. And so the reasons I don't think this is probably a good way to proceed is, number one, the pie is going to be cut smaller. And we all know what happens when the pie is cut smaller. There's less money to go around. And with that less money to go around, that means the tuition fees are going to have to go up, which means the young individuals who need to take this training probably won't. The other thing that we are able to do, because we are working with the Department of Public Safety, is we recently acquired a contract with the Minnesota Army National Guard. And because of our efficient program and the schools that we operate with, we are able to offer that at a lower cost as well. The other thing that I think it'll hurt is the greater Minnesota colleges, where that smaller population is. And because if the program gets watered down too much, the colleges will no longer be able to be into this business, and we'll be back right where we started before 2003. So if there's anything that I can help to defeat this, I am more than willing. And it's not that we're all scared of change, but when it's a change to move backwards, that's where we need to step in. So I appreciate any feedback, questions, any other information that I can give you, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and testifier. I would hope you could defeat it in the Higher Ed Committee. Hopefully this will go there. I would support the bill if there's more money being added, but to start giving public money to more private institutions and keep the pot the same, I think is not the way we should go with our public dollars, especially when the public institutions are the ones that hopefully have the accountability for how they're doing things, and the private institutions usually don't. So that is all a discussion for some other committee besides this one.
Yes.
Is that a plus or a minus for us?
Well, we're going to, you know, whether Representative Greiling is right or wrong, and she's wrong, I think we've kind of reached an agreement here about what the role of the Education Committee should be in this matter. We can address that, get that corrected as soon as possible, and move it on to the committee where the true debate about what the proper role of competition and government should take place. But I think we kind of reached a conclusion on that, and I'm sensing the committee did that as well. So with that, the chair is going to, Representative McDonald, do you have any closing comments?
No, I would just like to thank the chairman and the members of this committee for their indulgences and kindness to a new author, and hopefully that we won't have to bring this to you again.
Thank you. So with that, the chair renews his motion at House File 1586, laid over as amended for possible inclusion or later action in a later vote. Thank you, Representative McDonald.
Thank you.
Representative Downey. Representative Downey moves that House File 269 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. And Representative Downey, do you have an amendment to your bill?
Mr. Chairman, if I could, I was hoping to make a very small technical oral amendment on the way into committee. And as I reviewed the bill this morning, I actually discovered, while it's still technical, there's a couple of minor changes. So if I could describe them, and the chair and the committee can advise whether it's an appropriate oral technical amendment or not, I'd like to try and do that if I could.
Okay, so why don't you state that, and then we'll take a look at it.
The first is the easiest. It's the effective date needs to be changed on line 4.6 from 2011 to 2012.
And what were the other changes?
And then, Mr. Chair, on line 1.19 and on line 3.8, there's a reference to, it says, as required for collective bargaining agreements under section 123D.05, subdivision 2. I think I have a line through it, so I don't know if I got the numbers right there. Mr. Chair, those sections were modified with the elimination of the January 15th deadline penalty last year, and so that section reference doesn't refer to a section of statute anymore.
So it's an obsolete reference.
Correct.
So you're not trying to bring the January 15th penalty back, are you, Representative Downey?
Mr. Chair, that was not my design.
Okay. So Representative Downey if you're going to be striking that out, I guess I'm looking at Ms. Larson's not here.
She's up there.
So honor before. So,
Mr. Chair,
you're Representative Downing.
The stricken language should start on 1.19 with the word as, all the way through subdivision 2 on line 1.20. It is just that section reference that we're. So as required for collective bargaining agreements, that section.
Okay, so, but just to be clear, though, so on 1.19 through 1.20, you strike that, and then in addition on line, what's this?
3.8 and 3.9.
So those, but substantively, you're just eliminating an obsolete statutory reference.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Representative Greiling, is that all right?
Yep. Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So those are the amendments. Any questions on the amendment, and does staff have the amendments? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Downey, to your bill.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. We heard this and had a lot of discussion last session in both education policy and this committee. So I think I'll be brief in my introductory comments, and I think there's a couple of testifiers, and then we can have a broader discussion. The bill essentially says, and it's, I think, laid out very well in the House research summary and also in lines 1.8 through 1.16, that the purpose of the bill is to allow a school district to limit its contract offer to teachers to the percentage increase of state funding. And if it has made such an offer during contract negotiations to the teachers, equal to or greater than the state's funding increase to that district, that the teachers would waive their right to strike or interest arbitration. And then there's some definitions about what the terms compensation and the interaction between benefits and other wages are in the sections below that. The language is repeated in its entirety in Section 2 to cover cities of the first class. And so, members, the purposes of the bill, very straightforward, give the districts an ability to control their costs commensurate with the kinds of increases that they're getting from the state. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd pause for other testifiers or questions.
Thank you, Representative Downey. Do you have testifiers as part of your presentation that you...
Mr. Chair, I do.
Those individuals can come forward now. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Called sir. Thank you. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership, and we're here asking for your support of House File 269 because it'll help school districts avoid unnecessary cuts to teaching positions and program offerings. Too often we hear about teacher layoffs and program reductions because, in part, school boards were unable to settle contract negotiations within available revenues. 269, which creates the Qualified Economic Offer, or QEO, is a critical option for school boards. Rather than go into some additional description of the bill, I think Representative Downey did an excellent job. I'd just like to anticipate a couple of the arguments you might hear against House File 269 with a couple responses. One, that the QEO eliminates local control over contract negotiations. This is not true. No one is required to use the QEO. In fact, there may well be many school boards that choose to totally ignore it. Nothing will change for them, and that's fine. Even for those boards that choose to use the QEO, we'd expect that they first negotiate in the same manner as they always have, and was used the QEO as a last resort. Second, wouldn't increased funding for schools be a better solution for preventing teacher layoffs? We've looked at district contract settlements and state funding data covering 27 years, back to 1985. And in 18 of those 27 years, settlements exceeded increases in the state formula. As you know all too well, each district's budget situation is unique. And while state funding plays an important role, there are other key factors as well, such as student enrollment. In short, state funding can't be relied upon to prevent budget shortfalls in every district. School boards still need an option like the QEO to manage their budgets. And third, the QEO is a cap on salaries. Two thoughts. First, for those districts that choose to ignore the QEO, there is no impact. And second, for boards that choose to use it, it's presumed, again, that they first tried to negotiate salary increases through their normal process. However, if a school board is faced with a choice of agreeing to a contract settlement they can't afford, or trying to provide smaller increases to preserve teacher jobs and programs, we'd argue that the smaller increases in keeping teacher positions is best for kids. We understand there are a lot of factors involved with district budget issues. And if there's a better way to give school boards the ability to balance expenditures with revenues, we're interested. That said, we believe House File 269 will help districts retain teachers and program offerings, and ask for your support. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Barthel. Any questions for testifiers? Representative Amzo.
to the testifier and to Representative Downey, if you're so inclined. Could you tell me how many teacher strikes there have been in the last 5 or 10 years?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anzel, I can think of maybe 3, 4 in the last 10 years, perhaps.
Representative?
Thank you. You make my point. I won't even follow through on that. 3 was his answer. Can you tell me what the likelihood would be of a local school board at its first meeting with the bargaining unit, in the first minute of the first meeting, in the first paragraph of the first offer, from simply providing the bargaining unit with a QE offer? Isn't that going to be the motivator here? Isn't that what school board's behavior is going to be? And is that in the public interest? Is that an appropriate way to conduct collective bargaining negotiations with the process so tilted toward the employer? This is outrage, and I find your testimony pretty difficult to handle, and it's yet another assault on classroom teachers in every district. I find it really odd that never do you mention the 40 cents on a dollar that's being withheld to school districts. Instead, we got all these gimmicks designed to make it even more difficult for school districts and teachers and principals and school boards to provide these kids with a quality education. It's shameful.
Representative Downey.
Now, Mr. Chair, well, Representative Anzels, I think you've overstated the case substantially. There's nothing mandatory, Mr. Chairman, in the bill that would require a school district to do this. It's an option that they could avail themselves of. I know many districts and bargaining units have started on the interest-based bargaining process, and I think collective bargaining has advanced a lot in the recent years with that kind of a practice. I know we passed the repeal of the January 15th deadline penalty last year, and I don't know that that has resulted in any measurable increase in hostility or school districts somehow using that the absence of that provision in an unfair way to their advantage. I think many of us would argue that this, frankly, is leveling the playing field in the other direction, and so I think it's a pretty strong mischaracterization, A, to say or to imply that districts would automatically use this as the entry point of their bargaining and negotiation process, when I think it's advancing a lot to be a much more productive process on the whole. And second, I think it's unfair to infer or explicitly imply that the author's intent is that. That's not the case.
Representative Van Zyls.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate your time here. Do you refute the notion, Representative Downey, that this would, in most districts, become the first and final offer at the negotiations table? Do you refute that?
Representative Downey.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would just point out, I think it pretty clearly states in the bill that they have an ability to put a ceiling on their offer at the rate of increase of the state's funding if they so choose. But I certainly don't want to put myself into the mind of every school board member and every district negotiator throughout the state and say that this is what's going to happen. I guess if you're coming at it from the perspective that it appears you have, maybe that would be a logical conclusion you would draw, but there's nothing in the bill that says that they would have to behave that way, and I guess I have a little more trust in the good nature of most Minnesotans who are on school boards that this might be an option of last resort only in very difficult situations.
Thanks.
Representative Dampney.
Actually, Mr. Chair, I'd like to let more testifying occur before I raise questions. Thank you.
Have our next testifier, would you please move forward?
Mr. Chair, I had a question for Mr. Bartholomew.
Okay, well,
I thought I had my hand up, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry. Representative Ward, go ahead, Mr. Bartholomew.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bartholomew, how many teacher negotiations processes have you actually sat on in at the table?
Mr. Bartholomew.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, one or two at the early stages, introductory type stuff, but I'm not on a teacher collective bargaining panel or a school board.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll have a series of questions, Mr. Chair. Mr. Representative Downey, how many negotiations processes have you been actively engaged in, either as a school board negotiator or as a teacher negotiator?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, none.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair?
It's still Representative, isn't it? Representative Ward.
Thank you, Senator Garofalo. Mr. Bartholomew, I want to be clear on your answer because you indicated that you have been involved in the negotiations process sitting at the table. I want to be clear on that. I want to hear, you know, the actual, tell me how you were involved in the process, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, I did not mean to infer I was actively involved. I was an observer.
Okay, I wanted to be clear on that because that's
Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, because that's what I had heard. Mr. Bartholomew, you did testify, though, that, and Representative Downey, you have spoken often of local control, and Representative Mr. Bartholomew, you have indicated that local control will, in fact, not be harmed here or play a factor. And Mr. Bartholomew and Representative Downey, I have sat on a number of, and I know Representative Fabian has, and I know others in this, and Representative Breinert, and I think others on this committee Representative Zell, have been involved in the process. Have been involved in the local negotiations process when board members and educators sit at a table and negotiate what is best for them. Period. Over a long process, oftentimes adversarial, oftentimes stressful, oftentimes difficult, but to come up with a solution that is best for that district and those children in that district and those educators. I find it absolutely appalling that you would say that local control, this does not at all impact local control. It definitely impacts local control. When oftentimes I hear people down here talk about, you know, it has to be local control. We need to get back to local control. We need to allow local control until we think we need to do it better. We can do it better or whatever. And then we're going to put something in that really slants towards, you know, as Representative Anzelt said, the employer. I do believe, and I've sat at the table, and I do believe that the QEO would be an immediate kind of offer, would be an immediate kind of, you know, this is where we are. How about the years, Representative Downey, that there's no increase in the funding that we give to the education, like has been significantly in the past decade? What Representative Downey, does that mean that the offer then that the educators are going to receive is a 0% on salary and 0% on benefits? So it's a nothing. Does that what that mean, Representative Downey?
Representative Downey, when the Democrats froze the education funding, would this mean it'd be nothing?
Well, Mr. Chairman,
let's not edit here, Mr. Chair. Let me allow to ask a question.
Representative, are you asking a question or making a statement?
I'm asking a question, Mr. Chair. Did you not hear the question? I'll restate it.
I did not. Please restate it, Representative Ward.
Representative Downey, what happens when there is a 0% increase in state funding?
Representative Downey.
That was the question initially.
Mr. Chairman, I think the original question was what would have happened in the years when there was a 0% increase, and I would defer to Mr. Strom or Mr. Crow to maybe identify in the past 20 years when there actually was a 0% increase in the general formula.
Mr. Crow and Mr. Strom, over the course of, I guess we're looking at, Representative Ward, are you looking at dollar expenditures, looking at a per pupil amount, so staff can have a little stronger target there?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
So when's the last time that all spending on education funding did not go up?
Mr. Chair, we'll print out a list of the formula allowance increases. I'm not sure if we can link that in time for today's hearing with the total package increases on salary, but we've got a list of the formula increases here, and Mr. Crow is digging that out here. But per the Representative Downey's concern about that link to the settlements, I'm not sure if we can pull that together real quick.
Sure.
Or not.
Well, Mr. Chair, that Representative Ward, if you want to ask a follow-up.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to address this for me, you know, how does this promote working through local issues, Mr. Bartholomew or Representative Downey? How does this promote working through local issues on a level playing field with both parties at the table? How does it promote working through those local issues?
Mr. Chair, good, and actually, Mr. Bartholomew, happen to have a sheet here, which is not formal. We'll defer to the fiscal staff eventually. But since the year 2000, there were 2 years where there was not an increase, in 2004 and in 2010. So out of the last 11 or 12 years, there would have been at least some kind of an increase. And the short answer to your question, Representative Ward, is that if there were a 0% increase in the general education formula, then yes, the school districts would have the ability to put a ceiling on their offer at 0% without the teachers having a right to strike or interest arbitration. So that's the accurate answer to your question. The answer to your broader question about, and I think this is an answer to Representative Anzels as well, you know, we have the Public Employee Labor Relations Act in Minnesota, which is a unique set of guardrails and kind of binding processes on public sector employment negotiations. And that's above and beyond the National Labor Relations Act. And I had somebody, actually a labor attorney, suggest to me that perhaps we should just simply reorient all of PELRA to the National Labor Relations Act provisions and allow collective bargaining in the public sector to occur on a level footing with what occurs with collective bargaining in the private sector. And so I'm not proposing that. I'm proposing that in all of the guardrails and all the different provisions and all the different processes that are laid out in PELRA in Minnesota, here is one place where we tweak a guardrail. And so the implication that somehow we are creating an entirely new set of obstacles and barriers and infringements on local control just isn't true. We're tweaking one point of it, one fairly small point of it, and the statements that this is actually violating local control, I think, is a stretch. We're just tweaking the nature of what already is a huge infringement on local school district controls. And to say that it is creating an unlevel playing field, myself and the others who support the bill would argue that this is actually moving in the direction of a more level playing field.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Representative Downey, by your own words, you just said a minute ago, if there was a 0% increase, that the district would then be allowed to, you know, cap the salary and benefits and without the negotiations process. So, Representative, I mean, that's what you just said a minute ago in testimony. You just basically said the fact that that local control will not, I mean, local negotiations will not happen, you know, with that in that process. That's what I thought I heard you say. Maybe I'm not hearing things correctly or whatever, and somebody correct me if I'm wrong, but that's what I thought I heard you say. Is you made the point exactly what I've been trying to say, is that, you know, and Representative Manziel said that, you know, the district has the right to. Well, that's not negotiations. That's, you know, that's an employer having a significant right over an employee, quite frankly. So again, I just, when you make statements that I heard Mr. Bartholomew make, you know, I just really have some problems with the whole aspect here.
Representative Downey, what we usually do in this committee is we allow all public testimony, so people who've driven here have had the opportunity to testify, and then we have members give their questions to testifiers to make sure it's taking place. I had to step out and step out of here for a minute. So, have you completed the public testimony portion of this bill yet? Okay. Do you have any other testifiers you wish to bring forward?
Mr. Chair, I do.
Can you please have that testifier come forward? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, members, and my name is Grace Kelleher. I work for the Minnesota School Boards Association, and I'm here today to support Representative Downey's bill. Truly local school districts and local school budgets are tied to the state budget, and this recognizes that fact. It's pretty simple math. When we don't get anything from you, our ability to give to our employees is severely handicapped. Really funding school districts every 2 years with a budget that is up in the air to be sent by the legislature is really not a good way to run a railroad or a school district. We want to really encourage you to support local control, but keep in mind, local control is really difficult if we're not getting the funding from St. Paul. So in end, this would really bring pressure to bear on the legislature to fund education in a productive way. You know, we don't have a magic money tree sitting out behind the school district that gives us additional cash to give more money to our employees. School boards respect teachers and school staff enormously, and I don't know if we'll ever be able to compensate them adequately. But we can't give what we don't have. And I think this bill really sort of focuses in the legislative process. If we're not given the tools to change or enhance or become efficient, we're just stuck in a really bad place, Mr. Chairman, and this bill would really help us going forward.
Representative Downey, do you have any additional testifiers?
I do not, Mr. Chair. There may be others, but I'm not aware of them.
This is a public hearing. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns about the bill? Seeing no other testifiers? Just kidding. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jan Elswiger, Education, Minnesota. Do you know that I have actually now resorted to, instead of writing my name down when I testify, I have created little stickers. So I put them on the testifiers list because of all of the things that I am testifying against.
Ms. Elsweger, is that a rhetorical question, or are you actually asking the committee?
That was a rhetorical question, Mr. Chair.
Please proceed with your testimony, Ms. Elsweger.
First, to answer one of the questions, we've had 3 strikes in 17 years or more, I think. 3 strikes. That was with the January 15th deadline. That's gone. Now, this bill would take away that right to strike. But I have to say, what is the purpose of this bill? Really? Do we think teachers make too much? Because if you think teachers make too much, I suppose you'd consider passing this bill if you thought it was the right thing to do. But really, you look at some of the facts and figures as reported by the Minnesota Department of Education. Our salary ranking, Minnesota compared to the other states, was 16th. In 2004, we're now at 20th. And in fact, if I recall, in the mid-90s when I started, we were approximately 8th in the country. And while we are the 20th now, that might sound better than the average, we are actually $2,000 or $2,400 approximately below the average figure. In other words, those that who are up higher have a larger salary. The percentage of the school budget for teacher salaries has declined. In 2008, it was 38.8, 2010, 37.03. We are reducing the percentage for our teacher salaries compared to the rest of the budget. I have to agree with Representative Anzels. I think this is a first and final offer for school boards. And you know, when you passed that January 15th repeal, what did we see in the MSBA school newsletter? Don't hurry to settle. Take your time. If you want me to get the article, I'll be happy to send it to you. Well, you put that with this legislation that says going to the effective date. We actually think that this would affect the current bargaining round, so that districts who have already been working in good faith with the school employees because they feel like they had to, now would be able to, because they do have local control, to follow this. Make no mistake about it, they have local control to follow this, which would disrupt everything that they have done to this point if they have not settled. Do you remember when the Bush Foundation was here, I think last year, when we had a bill on, they were giving a presentation at the same time there was a wage freeze bill out there? One of their main points is that we have to attract and retain teachers. And they said that they had some concerns about that wage freeze. This first and final offer, the way this bill is written, let's just say we had a 0% increase. Because of the way this bill is written, they can subtract some compensations or some contributions by the school board. A couple of years ago, a pension change was passed. The school board contribution increased by 0.5% for each of 4 years. It also increased for the employee by 0.5% each year. So in that situation, if there was a 0% increase on the formula, and the employer over a 2-year period is increasing their contributions by 1%, the school board could put in their first and possibly final offer a cut of 1%, and the teachers could not strike. But the teachers are also contributing an additional 1%, so they'd see a 1% offer by the school board, and they are already reducing their paycheck by 1% because of their own contributions. So we want to attract and retain teachers. What have we done to teachers recently? Taken away the January 15th. There's changes in teacher evaluation. We actually have some performance pay that was passed last year. The younger teachers, actually this is almost all the teachers now, do not have the rule of 90. So their benefit, we have a two-tiered benefit system. We took away the 2% staff development set aside, and that funding is supposed to be used for improving the profession and the ability of our teachers to instruct students. We expect higher test scores. We expect higher graduation rates. We do not have enough resources. We're delaying funding to schools. We have teachers now. The amount is staggering now, if you talk to some of these individuals, who buy school supplies for kids, for their classrooms. Do we really believe that school boards need a law like this? I tell you, if they're not able to make good decisions, why are they elected? The community can decide if they're doing a good job or not. If you take a look at the salary settlements that our teachers have agreed on, last contract and this contract, we have a number of them agreeing to heart freezes or sock freezes. There isn't a problem that we're trying to fix, but the result of this bill would make us drop faster and farther in the ranking of salaries. It would make it more difficult to attract and retain teachers. Have you talked to teachers lately to check out the morale? I suggest you do. Thank you.
Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns about the bill? Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Toburin, representative with SEIU Local 284, school support staff, here to once again reaffirm our opposition to this bill. This is now the 50th or 60th bill weakening or undermining collective bargaining rights in some form or another. And I want to be very clear, the proponents of this legislation have done a very eloquent job of saying how this is a minor change and a small tweaking and a rebalancing of the table. But there, let there be no mistake about it, there is nothing small about this bill. There is nothing minor about this. This significantly changes PELRA and significantly changes the way public employee bargaining will work now and going forward in the future. For those of you who have not been actively involved in contract negotiations, especially in the public schools, it may be easy to think that this could be a minor change. But what this does is it really gets at the heart of the right to strike. And the right to strike is not a word we ever use lightly. It's not a word we ever like to even mention or talk about. And I can tell you the last thing that any one of our school bus drivers or food service workers or paraprofessionals or secretaries want to do is walk out of the job and walk away from the kids that they see every day. They have no desire to do that. And the reason why there have been so few strikes is because of the laws and the guardrails we have in place to keep it from getting to that level. Because in the private sector, when you walk out of your factory, widgets don't get made. But in the public sector, it's a completely different scenario. However, the right to strike is the only reason that the employer has to sit down with their employees as an equal and discuss terms and conditions of employment. So when you take that away, you don't rebalance the bargaining table, you've just eliminated the table, and there is nothing to sit at. School districts have and use tools every day to stop them from settling contracts they don't want to settle. I've sat at a number of bargaining tables, and I can tell you districts do not give up money they don't have or they don't want to give. We can come in and ask for a 5% raise, and they say no. They say no. And there's nothing I can do to stop that.
And it's not like I go in with a group of lunch ladies and we torture the superintendent until he has to give up money. They say no. And if there are school districts out there that feel they really need this, I would love to know which ones they are, because those are the contracts I want to bargain. Because that's been no experience of mine. And so I ask you to withhold from doing this today. There are real, real significant problems in education in the state of Minnesota. We have 40 kids in classrooms. We have kids sitting two to a desk. We have school districts that have school 4 days a week. And we have the greatest achievement gap in the nation, and that's criminal. And the members of SEIU are willing to stand with you shoulder to shoulder to work on those problems as soon as we can put away these Wisconsin-style collective bargaining bills and get on to dealing with the real issues that face Minnesota. So thank you for your time.
This is a public hearing. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns about the bill? Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Chris Lyon, and I'm the director of business, Bemidji School District. I spent 10 hours in mediation yesterday in the negotiations process. Hadn't planned on speaking today, but I'm looking at this bill, and two questions come to my mind. One is, what happens, as historically has happened with the legislature, when they roll in or roll out categorical aids into or out of the formula? For instance, when transportation funding was rolled into the formula, the dollar amount theoretically went up without an increase to schools. So I don't know the answer to that, but I'm asking the question. The second one is, as I look through the mathematical side of this and being in the trenches, actually having to put together a justifiable set of data, numbers that would in fact allow a school board to trigger a bucket of water on a strike. Who's the third party that's going to audit my numbers? Because they most certainly are going to be challenged. And I would envision that it would happen in every instance on every line item. So I don't know if these questions have answers, but I do think they need to be raised. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We can, on both questions, we can defer to staff or to the author. And Representative Downey, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe on the first question, in the case of a roll-in of a categorical where the general education formula went up on paper, but in reality the number was lower, that would necessitate the employer or the school district offering a higher increase in order to meet that threshold. Is that a correct statement?
Mr. Chairman, yes, as the bill is written, that's my understanding, but I might defer to staff if I don't understand the way the general ed formula works.
Sure. Mr. Crow, Mr. Strom, is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. And then with regards to the second question, how does the bill currently list who would be an arbitrator or a mediator to decide whether that threshold has been met, and how would that be addressed to the testifier's question?
Mr. Chair, that's a good question, and I don't know what happens at a local district level to provide any kind of an audit of an offer or the veracity of financial numbers during negotiation, but my assumption with the bill is that whatever that process and formal mechanism is, that would hold true in this case as well. And if there were something we needed to do to address that more clearly in the bill, I'm glad to hear suggestions on that and add that as we go.
Mr. Crow, Mr. Strom, any additional information, or Ms. Larson on that? No? Okay. This is a public hearing. Are there any additional members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns about the bill? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Jenny Holte. My question is related to, it's not a question of how much money the school boards have. The school board's money is determined by you. And if the teachers do not have a right to strike, then you can reduce the money that the school boards get, and the school boards can say, you can't strike. So the question is, how do we then put some onus on the legislation to make sure that you are funding education?
Thank you for your testimony.
Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns about the bill? Hi, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Rick Clark. I'm Superintendent Buffalo Lake Hector Stewart. My concern is I'm an Irish boy from the out east. I spent 26 years in South Dakota, a right-to-work state. On my third day of employment as a superintendent in Minnesota, I was introduced to the group known as the Bureau of Mediation Services. During my 12 and a half years, I have been blessed with seven settlements at two different systems, and this is a biennium. Part of the challenge to discuss with teachers about the money issue is I would suggest a good portion of teachers, when asked how much do you make gross and net and what are your deductions, are unable to answer that question. So when we sit down with a budget with funds 1 through 9, delayed payments, such items as categorical aid, which cannot be spent in certain areas, the state of Minnesota has basically two funds, Fund 1, Fund 2, and Fund 4. But they used to have Fund 1, which was general, Fund 2, which is lunch, Fund 3, which was transportation, 4, which is community service, 5, capital. And to break those into separate categories and have folks, other than Dr. Melcher, explain it generally is a challenge. So to sit at a table which is first-rate adversarial within the first couple of minutes, because you have a party who is looking for the long term and a party that is looking for the short term, but both are sitting at the table for the benefit of children. And then to have federal mandates who pay 6% of the bill and are now demanding 100% of the outcomes, special education rules and regulations, food service that is not permitted to spend in food service unless you get permission from them. That is the challenge at a negotiating table, to say, even though the dollar is showing up here, it's not available for you. And I would suggest if we started looking at the federal and state mandates and removed a number of the mandates, which are in fact unfunded, there might be some more money to sit down and negotiate on the local level. And I would concern myself mostly with the idea that administrators, boards of education, and teachers, for the most part, live together and are not interested in fighting, but will passionately fight, argue, defend a point till they put their name on the dotted line, and then they move forward back for the kids. And I suggest that some of the concern is the passion for which you and other legislators move forward might spend a little bit more time taking a look at the unintended consequences that come down the pike, because what is in the best and earnest interest winds up on my local board of education, which I have renamed the local board of blame, because they sit at the table with coffee and beer while you folks pass laws and the folks in Washington pass. So please take a look at all, whether you support this or whether you oppose this. I'm not here to bring that to your attention, but take a look at the unintended consequences and how it will affect not just now. How many times has this body had to come back to the table in a year because what it wrote is not what it meant, and forgot to pay great attention to the great old ideals? I know what I said. What did you hear? Thank you for your time.
This is a public hearing. Are there any other members of the public which testify in favor or voice concerns about the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion of this bill and we'll move to member questions. Representative Dabney, I have you first.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions at least to start off with for the author. Representative Dunn, I've got these scribbles all over the place. Representative Downey, on lines 110 and 111, you specify the general education formula allowance as the measure that you would use. And it causes me to think that a healthy organization, whether it's public sector, private sector, or nonprofit sector, actually has multiple strains of revenue. I'm yet to find a grocery store that sells only bananas. They usually do apples and pears and oranges, and that's only in the produce section. That was only the fruit department. And I think of school districts, and then you've got federal funding. You've got state funding. The state funding is you've got the general education formula, as the superintendent just said. You've got a number of categorical formulas, all of which can change over time. You've got local levies that districts may or may not have and have at different rates and for different terms. You could have grants that they've gone out and solicited from any number of foundations or community groups. You've got tuition that they may be receiving from neighboring school districts for providing special education services for non-resident students in that school district. So they've got multiple sources of revenue, and yet you identify a measure for negotiations on only one of those measures. Why is that?
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, I guess if you had an alternative suggestion that might work better, I'd be glad to hear it. We did think about that, and I think it's pretty clearly the general formula, typically the largest amount, and it's the one that is most universally applicable to every district, and so that seemed to be the fairest and most equitable measure to use. I would stand at the ready if you've got a suggestion for how to improve that.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Downey, to clarify further, right now, with your party in the leadership last year behind closed doors in a dark and locked Capitol building, your party prevailed, and we're now withholding 40% of school funding from the schools. So when you say on that line 110 and 111, the general education formula, do you mean the statutory number, the $5,224, or do you mean 60% of $5,224?
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, it would be the actual statutory appropriation pre-shift. I'll defer to staff if I have not accurately described that in the bill.
Mr. Chairman, given your party's predilection for school budget shifts, I would ask that perhaps we put some comfort language in to clarify for the public that when we're underfunding the schools through shifts, we still mean, in this case, the statutory formula, not the amount of actual money that schools are receiving. Further, looking at my notes, in 2008, if memory serves, Representative Downey, the emphasis in school funding went up, but the predominance of the school funding from the state was in special education. And it was an attempt to reduce the special education cross-subsidy that is the bane to districts across the state. Your legislation, were it to become statute, would really push the state legislature not to further fund special education. The superintendent just made some very good arguments about unintended consequences. I know Representative Loon was in tax committee last week, I believe it was, and found out, you know, because of the way the bills were negotiated in the dark last year, that elements of the tax bill that she'd gotten in, her language, bills she'd carried, had been changed and no one had even told her. Unintended consequences. Well, I don't know if unintended, but certainly not brought to the public's attention. What do we do with the special education cross-subsidy when we're incenting the legislature not to fund special education any further under your bill?
So that Representative Dad, I didn't catch the question. It was that this would incentivize districts to not fund special education?
This would incentivize the state legislature not to put additional funding into special education because they'd be getting pressure to put it on the general education formula because that's the only thing that's available for negotiations. Well, that's the only thing that's available for unilateral extension of contracts under Representative Downey's bill. Okay. Because his only metric is the general education formula, not the categoricals.
Okay, so I'm not following that. But Representative Downey, to that
well,
question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, we landed on the general education formula number as what we thought would be the most universally applicable and fairest number. And again, if there's a suggestion for how to weave some of the other categoricals or other special, you know, funding mechanisms into that to make it more fair and more practically realizable. And the hope was not to make it overly complex, but I'd welcome suggestions.
Representative Dabney?
I've got one last question. It's from Ms. Kelleher.
Ms. Kelleher, come on down. Is she still here?
Oh. Sneaky. Then I can ask it for of the author. What other basic functions of the school districts do you see them as incapable or incompetent at? Because clearly the message to Minnesota school boards is you're not capable or competent at negotiating contracts with the teachers, and we have to come in and protect you from yourselves. Because if we didn't have to do that, if you didn't see them as incapable or incompetent, there would be no need for this legislation. So in what other areas of their basic functioning are Minnesota school boards incompetent or incapable of functioning?
Representative Downey.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not quite sure how to answer that. Actually, if it were up to me, I had a bill that would actually allow teachers to be at-will employees, where I would provide the absolute and utmost degree of trust and confidence in local school districts, principals, and teachers to negotiate contracts, as is done in many other professional sectors in our society. Short of that, I guess if we were to actually honor your request, we would probably waive PELRA entirely and defer back to the National Labor Relations Act and not add any of the additional constraints for public sector collective bargaining that by your definition are all an affront to the intelligence and goodwill of the people who are doing negotiating at the local level. So actually in many ways, if I were to honor your request, I'd be going a lot farther in this bill than I am. This is just an attempt to provide one mechanism that levels the playing field and takes the current structure, leaves it very much largely intact, and just makes one change to it to, I think, the betterment of the process.
President Dabney, Ms. Kelleher is back in the room. Did you wish to ask her?
If I could, please. I was just going to ask.
Ms. Kelleher, and I'll let Representative Dabney restate the question.
Oh, you don't want to, Mr. Chair?
No, I would rather not.
Okay. Because you can if you'd like. Ms. Kelleher, you're out of the room. My question is of the School Boards Association. In what other basic functions of the school board, beyond collective bargaining, does the School Boards Association find its members incompetent or incapable?
Ms. Keller.
Mr. Chairman, our association supports elected school board members from around the state. Part of the requirement for being a school board member that makes them different than county commissioners and city officials is there is a financial training required of school board members in law that they participate, and we provide that training to our members. So I would argue that we've got competent members around the state who take required financial training in order to do the best they can with the dollars they're given from the state.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Devlin.
But Ms. Kelleher, if they were not incompetent or incapable in your organization's mind, why would they need special protections in law? They would be able to negotiate at the table contracts without this insult by Representative Downey and the School Boards Association.
Ms. Kelleher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Downey, school board members, too many D's today. Yeah. School board members around the state appreciate the staff and understand the service and the key role school employees play with kids. That's our focus going forward. Part of the frustration comes from a two-year budget cycle from the legislature that makes it difficult to have long-term goals, plans, and visions. Our expectations for our children are growing, and school board members feel those responsibilities coming forward. Currently, I sat on a bargaining table. I've bargained with teachers in my life. And presently, we're hearing from board members their struggle with union requests that are very high. They've bargained through the January 15th deadline, and the people who aren't settled are the people who are holding the line or can't give anymore. And this would give them protection. You know, the superintendent said school districts are a lot like a family living in the same house. We are, and our tendency is to get along and do the best we can for kids, and that's just a natural tendency going forward. This is reality, though. I mean, we haven't been able to produce for our school children of Minnesota the money they need at the local level. So if you can't give me the dollars we need to educate children well, you're making my job extremely difficult. I need other tools in my toolbox, and this would be a tool. Certainly not all boards would choose to do this. I mean, a lot of our boards get along very well and know where they're going with their employees. They're part of the solution. But some, when you start out at 38%, and after 5 or 6 months, you get down to 18%, those kinds of increases just don't exist anymore, and it takes the focus off kids. So in the general parameters, this bill would be another tool in our toolbox to successfully end negotiations and focus on kids.
Mr. Chair,
thank you very much.
I respect that it would be another tool in the toolbox. I think it's a bludgeon in the toolbox. And I think we forget that the end goal of labor law is labor peace, whether it's in the private sector or the public sector. That's the reason for the National Labor Relations Act. That's the reason for PELRA, so that everybody can go about doing the job of doing their job and not spend their time at the bargaining table. And using a bludgeon may work once, but we don't like it when people use it in families. And we shouldn't give it over to either side in school districts.
Thank you.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to revisit this categorical type discussion, because that's a couple of issues have risen in my own mind on that. And so I would like to, Mr. Chairman, first of all, ask staff, are there any of our categoricals that are rolled into the per pupil formula?
Mr. Strom or Mr. Crowe, I think, modify your question, that are in the general education formula allowance.
Yes.
Mr. Crowe.
Mr. Chair and members, if you look at that formula allowance sheet that we handed out, you'll notice that there are some notes on the first 5 years, A, B, C, and D. Those are reflecting changes in the formula allowance due to roll in and roll out. And the biggest one prior to that, the table just got too long, is in the year before that's shown on here. There was a $300 roll in of training experience and transportation revenue into the basic formula. So you can see, for example, in A, the formula in 98-99 is the net change from the rollout of $130 of training experience revenue from the general education formula. And then there are, examples in the other years of where different items were rolled in. And then in addition, in D, kind of separate from the categorical roll-in, in 2002-2003, there was the inclusion of $415 of referendum, the elimination of $415 of referendum revenue, and the formula increased by $415 that year.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, for example, that $415 that was rolled into the formula, did that apply to every school district?
$415 that was rolled in, did it go to every district?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dietrich, the added $415 on the formula went to every district. The net revenue for each district was different depending on whether they had $415 of referendum or not. If they did, it was a net zero of additional revenue. If they had $400, for example, they lost the $400 of referendum revenue, and their formula amount went up, or their revenue went up by $15 because of the extra $415 on the basic formula.
Representative
Dietrich? Yeah, thank you. I'd just like to go talk a little then about the transportation roll-in. What was that per student? Do you recall?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dietrich, the roll-in amount on the basic formula was $170 for the transportation roll-in.
And the year was?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dietrich, that would have been in 96-97.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So just on that note right there, I just would like to make the comment to the author of the bill, is that then $170 went onto the per pupil formula for transportation costs. And to say that that is now available for teacher salaries is wrong. We were trying to get rid of categoricals, but we never wanted that to go to teacher salaries. And so I think that that would need more help in that way. And then my third question, Mr. Chairman, if I may. Yeah, is the compensatory ed formula rolled into the formula?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dietrich, remember the general education program includes a dozen formulas. The biggest one is the basic formula, which is referenced here, and then compensatory is the next largest of the formulas that's within the general education program.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So by the wording used in the bill, the compensatory education money would not be able to be used for teacher salaries.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dietrich, that's correct, because the reference is to the general education formula allowance, which is just that basic formula allowance component of the general education program.
If I heard Representative Dietrich correct, she was saying it could not be used to pay for that.
Mr. Okay. Chairman.
Representative Dietrich, do you want to restate that question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the compensatory ed dollars that is distributed to schools on a per-pupil basis would not be able to be used as part of the general education formula allowance definition. So it couldn't be used for teacher salaries under this bill.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Representative Chair. Dietrich, that it couldn't be used to make the calculation in the subdivision, but they can use their revenue to pay salaries or to pay expenses. But the revenue, an increase in that revenue, for example, from one year to the next, couldn't be used in subdivision 3A in the calculation that's referenced where it says general education formula allowance.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will leave that as it is and try to help myself understand that a little bit more offline. But the next question is is the local property tax levied then still flexible? Can it, or does that mean now that this cannot be used for teacher salaries? Because it says in the general education formula allowance.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think what I'm hearing from Representative Dietrich's line of questioning is that the bill would somehow partition the actual funding streams from the state into a pool that could then be used for teacher compensation. All the bill is doing is saying it's the relative increase of the general ed allowance one year to the next that represents as a percentage number then the maximum increase that the district is required to offer the teachers to avert a strike. And so the district can offer whatever percentage they want. It's just we're using the increase in the general ed formula. To your point about the year when the transportation money was rolled into the general formula, that would create, if you did something like that again, moving from categoricals to the general, that would create a one-year blip, if you will, or perhaps slightly unnaturally large increase in the general ed formula. And in that year, the school districts would either have to live with that slightly unnaturally large increase in the general formula as their ceiling increase rate, or perhaps some one-off provision could be made in law as you're doing that to adjust for the fact that that would create a unnaturally large increase. But the point that we're somehow categorizing funding streams for salaries and not isn't at all the purpose of the bill. It's just the general formula increase is used as the most appropriate measure to put that ceiling on the rate increase that a district would be required to offer in order to avert a strike, if that makes sense.
Representative Dietrich, you done, or?
I would just like to ask one more time then. So the other categorical funding that is not included in the general education formula allowance, the money that comes into the district, is still all discretionary money and can be used for salaries, can be used for anything that they would choose if they decide to go with this qualified economic offer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dietrich, I'll say yes, although I know some of those funds have parameters on how they can be used, but the again, the purpose of segregating off the categoricals isn't to say that money can't be used for X or Y or Z. That's already prescribed in the way those categoricals are defined. It was just to land on what we thought was the most appropriate measure for to accurately and fairly represent the increase in state funding.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will just continue to look into this because I am missing then what is the point of putting this in statute then, if all the funding is open to, even if you go with a qualified economic offer, then what is the point of fencing off this definition, this money for an increase when there are, you know, we have QComp, we have compensatory ed, we have lots of other things that goes into teachers' salaries, and so in essence, they can all still be used to have a larger increase.
Representative Downing.
Mr. Chairman, I think I agree with your statement. The purpose is, again, not the mention of the general ed allowance in here as the measure by which you're going to gauge this percentage increase of funding from the state doesn't really have anything to do with the way the funds flow down to the schools or how they use that money. It's basically to say if we wanted to give the school districts a ceiling, percentage increase ceiling on their offer, above which teachers would not be able to strike, we thought the general allowance was the fairest number to use. We could have aggregated all of it together, but then you have a lot of variables in there that are hard to track. So we're trying to stay as simple as possible.
Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the points that's been made by more than one testifier here and by the author in one way or the other is that negotiations this cycle don't appear to be concluding in a expeditious, fair, satisfying manner. I think most of us who are close to our boards of education and teachers and superintendents and professionals in our schools have this sense that negotiations are proceeding very, very slowly. And I would say that's because of the elimination of the date and the fact that this legislature withheld 40 cents on a dollar in the 2011 session. There is no impetus, there is no drive, there is no motivation to settle. Why would you settle an agreement under those conditions, especially when the legislature comes back and is consumed by frivolous, unnecessary, punitive attacks on the very people who are charged with educating our children? And I really get a kind of a kick, actually. The further you get away from the classroom, the further you get away from kids, the more inclined you are to dream up all of these things, all of these proposals that do nothing to focus on kids. But you get into what you think are processes which somehow magically are going to result in a better product and a better outcome. It's foolish. You shouldn't be doing this, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Downey, you're a fair and decent and very, very sharp guy. You ought to know better than to do this.
Representative Reinhart, Kelly, and then we're going to vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Downey, I'd like to ask you how or why a contract would come to be settled under a QEO.
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I don't understand the question. It would be bargained.
Mr. Chair, okay, my suggestion is that a qualified economic offer leaves the settlement of the contract in no man's land. There's no motivation to settle the contract. You've determined how the pay will proceed. The non-compensation issues could be go to arbitration, but there certainly isn't any incentive for management to take those issues to arbitration. There would be no contract, as far as I can see. And I've done this for 12 years. I understand the process. I don't think you would have a contract. So, you know, what is the end result here in terms of negotiations?
Representative Downey?
Mr. Chairman, again, I'm not sure I totally understand the question. It seems the premise is that two sides negotiating could not ever come to an agreement absent the ultimate threat of a strike as an end outcome or arbitration, interest arbitration. And I guess I don't agree with that premise. I know another testifier earlier said that the right to strike is the only reason that management sits down with labor. I have a higher estimation of our school boards and the intentions of both parties, and so I guess I'm not sure I totally understand. There's no reason they couldn't come to a negotiated settlement. It just says that if the district has made an offer at a certain level, that the teachers would at that point not have the right to strike or go to interest arbitration, which doesn't mean that the district, even in that circumstance, wouldn't bring in a mediator or you know, use whatever facilitation techniques they have in contract negotiations to settle. So I guess I'm not totally understanding the question.
Representative Bryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to belabor this point. I'm total supporter of collaborative or interest-based bargaining, and that's what I did for a number of years. And I think it does get to the result whether a strike is on the table or not. But I actually think this qualified economic offer could inhibit a settlement because it sits on the table as a required resolution, dictates how the employee benefits and compensation will flow, and it could simply sit there with no resolution. So I don't know what the incentive to move forward in bargaining would be if there isn't movement. In other words, this could actually be an excuse for not negotiating. And I'm not saying the strike has the power. I'm saying the QEO actually is a disincentive to negotiate.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I just disagree that somehow this means all negotiations are going to forever end up in no man's land because the district has an opportunity to come in on minute one of day one and hang this out here as a threat, and so then the two parties sit there, you know, for another 2 years never settling. But if I could, Mr. Chairman, maybe just a technical question of staff. I know at the state level, if you don't settle, that the prior contracts perpetuate, and I don't know whether that is the same under Pelmer for school districts or what actually happens when the two parties have not settled.
Mr. Crow, Mr. Strong?
Yes, please.
Ms. Larson? I believe the answer is yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Breiner, any follow-up?
No.
Representative Kelly?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Downey, I'd like to thank you for bringing this forward. It seems to me that any time we start looking at the negotiation process, it gets tense. And I really have a hard time, Representative Van Zels, when you talk about that any time we do this as attack on the collective bargaining unit and as though the collective bargaining unit is the only group that cares for kids. And I think that's completely wrong. One of the things that You asked about the number of times there's been a strike in the last 5-10 years. And I'll tell you, if it was one, it was too many. I lived through that strike in a community, and it divides, and there's just losers. There's no winners in that. So if we can avoid any strikes, that's what we should be doing. Representative Dandy, something struck me when you talked about it. It was a kind of a family atmosphere, and you don't bring these type of instruments or tools into that family atmosphere. And you know, you're right, and Representative Ward, I did serving the board for quite a while and went through the bargaining process. I can tell you the first time, I believe I was rather naive. I thought I was pretty good with numbers, thought I understood finance. And so I went to we as a group went to the bargaining unit, and I thought, well, let's try something different. Let's just go in with what our numbers have said we can offer. Let's just go in and say, this is what the district can do. Let's work together and do that. And boy, everybody told me that you can't do that. It doesn't work that way. You just have to come in with a lot higher offer. They'll come in with their lot higher offer, and you'll sometimes meet in the middle. Well, I learned from that one. That's exactly what happened. It took us over a year to settle a contract, and it was a lot of time and effort on both sides. So the next time around, of course, what did we do? We came in with a much higher number. The bargaining unit came with a much higher number, and now we knew that we were going to have to play this game. So Representative Downey, the way I see this is a great tool. This could create a baseline. Now, whether it's a limit or not, I would appreciate that from being on the school board, is to be able to have that baseline to say, we know what our parameters are. And now let's talk from a starting point so that maybe we can conclude this in a much, much more efficient manner. So I appreciate you coming forward with that and certainly support your bill.
And I can't say no to my friend Representative Greiling. You'll get the final word before the closing author. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first I'd like to ask for a roll call.
Roll call has been requested.
Thank you very much. I think all the points have been made here today, and so I'm not going to even try to make them as well as a lot of my colleagues have already made. But I would like to ask the author or Mr. Bartholomew one final question. It seems to me that, we're imposing a lot of confusing mandate on the school districts. Representative Dietrich pursued that line, to what end? And the real question is what the parent asked earlier, why aren't we funding education? And instead of trying to figure out some way to squeeze blood out of a turnip by not paying our teachers when no one that I've ever heard has said they earn too much. I've actually never heard that from a Republican even. Even people like Representative Krinke or people like that have, I bet Representative Downey wouldn't say that either with your father having been a teacher. So the real problem here is the funding of education. But we're trying to impose the system on here to wedge some sort of an outcome that we have created ourselves by the lack of funding. And we always have to look to businesses to have the answer and figure out how we can have public entities do what businesses do. So could you point me to a business or Mr. Bartholomew that actually is forced into this kind of a box where they have some extrinsic factors that are imposed upon them when they're doing their own collective bargaining with their employees? In other words, what's good for the goose, good for the gander? We always get these answers for schools from business, but I want to know, in this case, is business doing this?
Representative Downey.
Well, Mr. Chair, I can answer well. Mr. Bartholomew comes down and he can offer his answer. I think this is probably one of the distinctives between private sector collective bargaining and public sector, and that is the private sector is always 100% absolutely constrained by their financial limitations. And I think that's one of the differences between the negotiation process. The bargaining units have at least some understanding of that, and they understand that the combination of their cost and their value add is a contribution to the financial health of that organization, and they realize the financial constraints because that's just what private sector entities operate under. And private sector bargainers do not have to operate under the heavy weight of PELRA in Minnesota. They have a different set of bargaining regulations. I think almost all of those come nationally. We don't have another state-imposed set of collective bargaining rules and processes here on the private sector. So I think it's fundamentally different. And I would argue one of the challenges that we're facing, and this is one of the things that has always struck me since I've been down here, is that we have a profession, teachers, a noble profession, people that are much like the management consultants that I hired. We heard from the Bush Foundation, you know, what does a teacher want in their job? What are they really looking for? They're looking for a leader, typically the principal in the building, to create an atmosphere of excellence and advancement and achievement. They're looking for the tools and the freedom, just like any other worker in the private sector is, to do a good job and be part of something that they're really proud of. They're expecting to be you know, held accountable for some outcomes. And so I think those are the fundamental and overriding things. And here we have, in this environment, and you hear all this discussion here today, and, you know, we've locked our people and our districts down into this process. And so, yeah, we're changing one element of it. But to argue against this change on one element of it, because the whole thing puts people in a bad position, professional folks in a bad position, I don't think it's an argument against the bill. I think it's a bigger argument and a broader argument against the entire enterprise as we've defined it here. And we do define it. We do control all this down here, so we've got to make the changes here.
Representative Bradley?
Mr. Chair, I would hear Mr. Bartholomew's answer, too, and I would thank you for letting me interject, though, before we get to that. I'd like a more specific answer. Some company that's actually has something from some outside entity that constrains how they can bargain with their employees, and I could, you know, we don't have enough time for me to debate Representative Downey, but Representative Downey, you know, when you say businesses are constrained by how much money they have and that's their bottom line, I would point us to, you know, the many bailouts we've been looking at for big business, big bucks from our taxpayers that have gone to businesses that have gone over their bottom line. I don't think that's a model that it's us that's not balancing our budget, not the school districts. And so I think that's a fallacious argument that you're making. And, of course, business has a lot of places to go if they don't have money. They have products that they can decide how much they want to charge for. They have multiple ways that are, you know, we have local governments that have to look to property taxes when we don't fund them, and that's something that people really don't like. But their businesses have a lot of tools to deal with their bottom lines and not just how much they're paying their employees. But I wanted a specific company that has some other entity like we're proposing to do for the local school districts here with this legislation that tells them that they have to do something when they're negotiating. It's my perception, Mr. Chair, that that businesses doesn't, and they're dealing with the free market. And so I'm trying to find out if you could give one example of a business that someone else is telling them how to bargain, like we're proposing to tell our school districts.
Mr. Bartholomew?
Mr. Chair, Representative Grayling, I will try to find a comparison of federal labor law and PELRA to see if that can identify some of the differences. If that would be okay, I'll follow up with you on that.
Representative Grayling.
Thank you.
Okay. Members, a roll call is being recorded. Representative Downey, do you have any closing comments?
Mr. Chair, let's take the vote.
All right. The clerk will take the roll.
Representative Garofalo?
Yes.
Representative Kelly?
Yes.
Representative Anderson?
Yes.
Representative Anzels?
No.
Representative Bills?
Yes.
Representative Reiner?
No.
Representative Daphne?
No.
Representative Dietrich?
No.
Representative Downey?
Yes.
Representative Erickson is excused. Representative Grayling?
No.
Representative Loon?
Yes.
Representative Mariani is excused. Representative Myra?
Yes.
Representative Peterson?
Passed.
Representative Quam?
Yes.
Representative Slocum?
No.
Representative Ward?
No.
Representative Fabian?
Yes.
Representative Peterson?
No.
Mr. Chair? I didn't get a chance to vote on that. I know a lot of people would actually like to be in this chair.
No, sorry, but you didn't see that as part of the new redistricting plan. It's so Republican, you actually lost your vote, Representative.
I thought Representative Ward and I in our new Senate seats might have been taken out of
All right, Representative out of Woodard, your vote?
Representative Woodard?
Yes.
Your own L.A., too. That's the best part. There being 10 ayes and 8 nays, the motion prevails, and the House File 269, as amended, is adopted. Members, very quickly, we have the minutes from two meetings. Representative Greiling moves approval of the minutes from the February 15th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. And on the February 21st amendment minutes, Representative Loon moves approval of the adoption of those minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. Minutes are adopted. Members, we are adjourned. Thank you very much. Thank you.